Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson. This evening, Lois Reitzes will be sitting in for me in another engaging interview on Between the Lines. So, stay tuned.
"Imagine a pair of woman's lips," Mogor whispered, puckering for a kiss. "That is the city of Florence. Narrow at the edges, swelling at the center, with the Arno flowing through between, parting the two lips, the upper and the lower. The city is an enchantress. When it kisses you, you are lost, whether you be commoner or king."
That's Sir Salman Rushdie reading from his most recent book, The Enchantress of Florence. Welcome, and thanks for going between the lines. The story is as intricate as some of the filigree patterns common to the art of both its settings. Tell us why you chose Sicri and Florence.
I guess just because they were both cultures having a golden age, you know, and that's we're much more familiar with the golden age of the High Renaissance. We know about the paintings and the literature and the, you know, the sculptures and the buildings and so on, but it's less well known, certainly in the West, that in India in the 16th century, there was an exactly similar Renaissance taking place, and during the reign of the six great Mughal emperors, but none more so than the third of the six, the Emperor Akbar, so called Akbar the Great, under whose reign he was very fond of the arts, and he gathered together at his court all the most brilliant musicians, dancers, painters, poets, etc. So it became really the pinnacle of the Indian art of the classical period, the second half of the 16th century. So I thought, here are these two worlds, both having a glorious moment, you know, and yet, really, at that time, they barely knew each other. They were just beginning to be aware of each other. And there were a few European travelers who showed up in India. The Portuguese had just established their little colony in Goa. Vasco da Gama had showed up in South India to begin the spice trade. And there were one or two merchants and just Marco Polo-like wanderers, you know, but very, very few. And the thing that, in a way, gave me the engine for the story was that I realized that in the opposite direction, there was no journey at all. I mean, if you look for travelers coming from India, mm-hmm. and traveling west, I literally couldn't find a single example, you know. And this immediately tickled the novelist's perversity, you know. And, and I thought, let me make the thing happen that didn't happen. Let me have the journey, instead of the more conventional journey from the west into the east, let me have the bizarre journey from the east into the west. And then I thought, if it's a woman making the journey, it's even less likely that it would have happened, and therefore even more of an interesting challenge to make that happen.
Well, it must have been all the more challenging because many of your characters are historical figures. Isn't that daunting?
Yes, it is. But I had to find a story that could fit into the real history of the world, you know, and feel as if it belonged there, you know. So, and actually, because I was, you know, I was a historian. I mean, that was my subject at college. So I have respect for history, and I didn't want to fool around with it too much. I mean, I think as a novelist, it's okay to take small licenses. You know, there are moments when I pushed a couple of historical dates apart by 6 months in order to make the story easier to flow, you know. But on the whole, I wanted people to feel, if you had been in Florence at this time, at the time of Machiavelli and Botticelli and the Medici Dukes and so on, it might have been like this, you know. And if you had been in the streets of Akbar's capital city of Sicri in the 16th century, this may have been the world that you would have found there. You know, it's, I wanted people to feel trust, you know, because I think as a reader, it's the thing you most want to feel about a book is that you can trust the storyteller. Mm-hmm. You know, and at the moment that you feel that, then you relax and let him tell you a story. You know?
Well, we have a few stories unfolding within the story. Mm-hmm. I must say, going back to Akbar, his character is so vividly drawn, and it's after his encounter with Rana mm-hmm. that we begin to see the contradictory elements in his nature. He commits this brutal murder,
mm-hmm.
but then he feels guilty.
He feels bad, but he weeps, yes.
Yes.
A weeping murderer.
I have to say that your adding humor made it so much easier to read about this brutality, but it's very funny.
Oh, yeah. Your time has come, the emperor assented. So tell us truthfully before you go, what sort of paradise do you expect to discover when you've passed through the veil? The Rana raised his mutilated face and looked the emperor in the eye. In paradise, the words worship and argument mean the same thing, he declared. The Almighty is not a tyrant. In the house of God, all voices are free to speak as they choose, and that is the form of their devotion. He was an irritating, holier-than-thou type of youth, that was beyond question. But in spite of his annoyance, Akbar was moved. We promise you, the emperor said, that we will build that house of adoration here on earth. Then, with a cry, Allahu Akbar, God is great, or just possibly Akbar is God, he chopped off the pompous little twerp's cheeky, didactic, and therefore suddenly unnecessary head. Yes, it's a very interesting thing about Akbar that he comes, after all, from generation after generation of bloodthirsty warlords. You know, this is a descendant of Genghis Khan, Tamerlane, so on. And he himself was, you know, not at all a stranger to chopping people's heads off and doing such things. There's a story, true story, about a sort of pathetic attempt to lead a coup against him. And when it was defeated, he was a very big man, Akbar. He picked up the ringleader and threw him off the parapets of the capital city. And when he failed to die, he went down and picked him up, took him back up to the top, and threw him off again, only this time head first. And that worked.
He'll remember that for next time.
So, you know, if in doubt, if you ever want to kill somebody, throw them off the parapet head first. But, so on the one hand, there's that side to him. And on the other hand, and it's not surprising that there's that side to him given his ancestry. You know, but on the other hand, he has this extraordinary dream of peace and wanted and saw the future as being the future he wanted to construct was a place not of conquest and oppression and barbarism, but of peace and coexistence. And it's rather extraordinary that an illiterate boy who came to the throne at the age of 14 as the child of such savagery should himself, almost from the beginning, I mean, almost from the age of 14 or 15, begin to dream of peace. And it makes him the most extraordinary transitional figure, if mm-hmm. you like, from the ancient world, the world of the Golden Horde and Genghis Khan and Mongol invasion, so on, from that world to the modern world. You know, Akbar, in a way, stands on that threshold mm-hmm. and makes him very interesting to write about.
What we would call civilized.
Yeah, the beginning of civilization. And as a result, what is born around him in his court is the greatest civilization that the country had seen. I mean, the best painting, the most brilliant music, the greatest poetry, the most fantastic flamboyant architecture. I mean, his grandson, after all, is the one who built the Taj Mahal, but that process had begun long before. Mm-hmm. So, yes, he had wanted a court of all the talents, and he brought them around him and cared about them, you know, cared a great deal about the arts.
And one more example of how Sikri is a reflection of Florence.
Yeah, because there you have at the same time, remember that these Florentine dukes were no Democrats. You know, the Medicis were the people who actually, you know, comparable to my story about throwing the revolutionary off the roof. I mean, they hanged the archbishop. When they defeated the Pazzi conspiracy, the archbishop was found to be one of the conspirators. They hanged him out of the window of the palace in full regalia, just a dangling archbishop hanging in the sky. So, you know, they were, in their way, every inch as brutal. They were torturers and poisoners, and also they were warlords in a way. There were endless wars in this period. And yet they, too, gathered around them and created around them an atmosphere in which the great flowering of European civilization took place. So it's interesting to me that there is this similarity both of barbarism and of civilization, mm-hmm. you know, in the two worlds at the same time. And so the mirroring, in a way, made them unusually interesting to face off against each other, mm-hmm. if you like.
And as Akbar, we see the emergence of reason.
Mm. Yes.
Taking over his thought. He doesn't abandon the idea of the supernatural or the enchantress. And this, I think, first shows itself in the character of Jodha.
Who he makes up, yes. He makes himself up an ideal woman. He has I just gave him this Pygmalion-like ability to dream up a human being just by the sheer force of his will. I mean, he's that omnipotent a monarch that he can actually bring people to life. And one reason for doing it is that the case of Jodha in Indian history is very strange, that if we were having this conversation in India and we were to ask the listeners, you know, who was the queen of Akbar the Great? You know, 99.9% of them would phone in and say that, of course, obviously, it was Jodha or Jodhabai. That's what everybody would think. And they would tell you things about her. They would say that she was a Hindu Rajput princess, and it was a sign of Akbar's great tolerance that he never forced her to convert to Islam, and that, in fact, he would join her in her religious observances, you know, as a sign of how people should live side by side and worship side by side. All of this is very beautiful, but the trouble is, if you look at the actual historical record, there was no such person. It's the story of a princess who goes missing, that's to say. And this, things like this did happen. Sometimes people had to surrender women to rivals as the price of peace, or et cetera. You know, and indeed, it's true that Akbar's grandfather, Babur, once had to surrender his sister in this way to a rival warlord when he was besieged by him in Samarkand. But anyway, it just gave me the idea of how a woman could, first of all, get detached from her own people and her own place and begin to bounce across the world. You know, so this is a story about a princess who is captured in that way by a rival warlord. And then when he is defeated by the king of Persia, she becomes the king's consort for a while. And then when he's defeated, she's rather good at changing horses. She falls in love with his vanquisher, who is this Italian soldier of fortune who at that point is working for the Ottoman, the Turkish Sultan. And they fall in love. I think they genuinely fall in love. And then he brings her back to Florence, where she creates a great fuss. And she's probably a witch. So that would be a summary of her. But this idea of witchcraft and magic, which you brought up before, I think it's very important because, first of all, this is a world in East and West in which people genuinely believed in magic. You know, they believed in magic as we might believe in science. You know, and they didn't think of magic as being something separate from reality. Mm-hmm. They believed magic to be a part of reality like anything else was, you know, and used it in their daily lives. I mean, if you fell in love with somebody, you went to get a love potion, you know, obviously. And if you wanted to do somebody down, you tried to get a lock of their hair and then get somebody to put a hex on them. You know, but the sense of that supernatural world existing side by side with the natural world all the time mm-hmm. is one of the real things that united the East and the West. And so the idea that a woman, particularly a beautiful woman, might be actually capable of casting actual spells was one that got some credence in the Renaissance. And partly it's because the Renaissance was obsessed with antiquity. So they would read about the Greeks and the Romans, and they would find these stories of people like Circe, you know, enchanting Ulysses and keeping him under her spell. And so the idea of the witch changed from being an ugly old hag to being a beautiful seductress, you know, but literally with powers of sorcery. And that's what, when Caracos, the princess, arrives in Italy, people begin to believe her to be capable of literal enchantment. Everybody can see that she's gorgeous and they desire her, but they also think that she's capable of curing the sick. And, you know, sterile women claim that she's touched their stomach and they became pregnant. And so even the Pope begins to suspect that she might possibly be a miracle-working saint. But it struck me that this attitude towards beautiful women was actually potentially very dangerous for the women concerned. That, you know, it's a knife edge to walk, because it's about mob appeal, you know. And the thing about the attitude of the mob is it can change very fast, you know. And that one minute people worship you for being an enchantress, you know, and then there's a change in the mood and the change in the wind, you know, and the same people who were adoring you come round to lynch you or to burn you at the stake, you know. And it's a knife edge to walk, which she has to walk, and actually it doesn't go well for her.
Is it revealing too much to talk about the three boyhood friends?
Oh, no, I don't. No. I think that's the subject of friendship is very important in the book, you know, and in the way that Akbar in India has intimate male friendships mm-hmm. with courtiers. I wanted that to have an echo in the Italian part. And so Machiavelli, as a boy, the boy Niccolo, and two of his friends, one of whom really existed and one didn't. The one who really existed was Agostino Vespucci, who was a distant cousin of Amerigo and who was a boyhood and adult friend of Machiavelli's. He and the third one, who is the boy who grows up to be the soldier of fortune who falls in love with the enchantress, Argalia, he's completely made up. But I wanted to start with this root of friendship and then to say, you know, take these three children who loved each other as boys, send their lives in different directions, see what happens to the friendship. You know, and that's also an important theme in the book.
Oh, yes. If you're just joining us, I'm Lois Reitzes, and we're going between the lines of The Enchantress of Florence, the new novel by Sir Salman Rushdie. Well, it's boys we were talking about, and I wasn't sure if it was giving away too much, but Il Macchia is, in fact, Machiavelli.
Is Machiavelli, yes. I've always wanted to write about him, and I finally found a way of writing about him both when he's a child and kind of before he's Machiavelli, and then in older age, yeah.
But he is still, but even as a child, he's looking for that mandrake root, and,
yes.
and that makes its way into the story.
Yes, and I mean, after all, his play, The Mandrake Root, La Mandragola, was the biggest hit comedy of the Renaissance. You know, so it's a thing not often remembered about Machiavelli is that he had a lighter side. You know, that it wasn't all power politics and cynicism and so on, that he was also a comedian, quite considerable comic writer. And as I've tried to show in the book, quite a lad about town, you know. I mean, a young man who liked to go out drinking and whoring.
The end justified, the means justified the end.
And was seen by his friends as the life and soul. I mean, he was the person they turned to organize all their fun. And he liked to go drinking and gambling. And you know, this was also, of course, the age of the courtesan. So these great the houses of the courtesans, again, one of the things that the East and the West had in common. The same thing was happening in India. These were much more than just brothels. I mean, these were like social clubs. Mm-hmm. You know, these were places where you would meet the wittiest wits and the most beautiful women and the greatest musicians and singers and dancers and so on. And they were quite exclusive clubs. It wasn't easy to get in. You know, you had to have the right introductions and invitations to get into these places.
We really don't have a modern-day equivalent of the courtesan. I mean, think about operas. Think about Violetta.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
She wasn't a prostitute.
No, she was something altogether more elevated.
And we don't have it.
No, we don't. And the reason is we don't lock up our women anymore.
Ah.
I mean, the reason why the courtesan culture flourished, both in the Florentine Renaissance and in the Mughal Empire, was that the aristocratic families would all sequester their women. You know, the women didn't walk around on the streets and go out on dates with boys. You know, they were locked up at home, and usually their marriages were arranged. And their marriages were not arranged for reasons of love. They were arranged for reasons of family benefits, for treaties. You know, if the Medicis and the Borgias wanted to cement some peace treaty, they would marry a daughter of one house to a son of the other house. And now what happens in any world where you lock up the girls is that the boys have to look elsewhere. And that's why the world of the courtesan blossomed in this period in Italy, and in exactly the same way and for the same reason in India. You know, it's to do with now that women aren't sequestered in that way, there's no need for that phenomenon. You know, it simply is redundant.
If the book seems at times like a love letter to the city of Florence. Mm.
It is.
It is. And it's also a testament to language and to the importance of stories. He who can tell stories will survive.
I hope so. You know, I mean, I've always thought, you know, when I'm writing a novel, I actually don't read much other fiction, you know, because I just don't want it to infect what I'm writing. But what I do read a lot and every day when I'm writing a novel is poetry. And not any particular poetry, just almost at random, and not necessarily a lot, maybe just one or two poems a day, because the reason I do it is that the level of attention to language in a poem is as high as it ever gets in writing, you know, and it's always seemed to me that there was no reason why the level of attention to language in a novel should not be as great as it is in a poem. It's just that it means a novel would take much longer to write, but that's all right, you know. I mean, nobody's in a hurry. You know, it seems to me better to take the time to give the language as much voltage as it can have, you know, to make sure it's as charged and that it means as much as it can mean, you know. And that's the art of literature is that of creating meaning, you know, and of showing readers what an event or a person or a relationship or a historical moment, what it might mean and how much it might mean and why that's important. And all of that can be put into the language, and it just means that it takes longer to make the language, give the language that kind of, if you like, supercharge, you know. But and reading poetry is very, a very useful way of reminding a novelist to pay attention.
Whose poetry do you like to read?
You know, everything. I mean, really very different kinds. I mean, C.P. Kavafi, Derek Walcott, W.H. Auden, Berryman. I'm a huge John Berryman fan.
Do you like Neruda?
Neruda, yes. I mean, the lyrical Neruda more than the political Neruda, actually.
Yes.
I mean, the kind of love poetry more than the public poetry, if you like. I read, as I say, a lot of poetry, and it's not of any one particular kind. It's just almost going to the bookshelf and picking a book off and opening it and reading something, you know. It's a forgotten thing now. We used to be allowed as children, or forced as children, to memorize poetry. Every week, or sometimes more than that, you'd learn a poem. And some of them have stuck in my head, and the ones that haven't stuck in my head completely have remained there in part. And I think it's enriching to have that in your memory. You know? I mean, the writer that I know, the two writers who have the most extraordinary memory capacity for this kind of thing are Martin Amis and Christopher Hitchens. And they carry around in their heads more than anybody has any right to do. You know? you just say the name of a poet, and they will immediately start reciting.
We should have a poetry showdown.
Yes, it would be like a slam. Yes, exactly. We could have that, yes. They would win. The best I would come in would be third.
But I think your writing is more poetic.
Well, that might be my revenge.
You do poke fun at yourself and certainly your art. You're talking about poetry. You write about poets and artists, those preening egoists who claim for themselves the power of language and image to conjure beautiful somethings from empty nothings, making fun of yourself.
Comedy is, you know, I don't like writing that doesn't have a sense of humor. I mean, speaking as a reader, you know, there is great literature that I find hard to penetrate because of its humorlessness. You know, I once admitted on an English television program that I'd never managed to finish Middlemarch. And the absolute shock.
And they knighted you
in spite of not having finished Middlemarch. And I mean, my problem with Middlemarch is that it's, you know, no doubt wonderful, but there isn't a smile in the whole 800 pages or whatever it is. And I just have a problem with that as a reader. And so, you know, you write, hopefully you try and write the kind of books you'd like to read. Mm.
In addition to the mirrors, there's this exploration of the self, a leitmotif.
I'm glad you said that, because I think the great thing that's happening in this moment of the history of the world, especially in Europe, in the Renaissance, is that the idea of the self, the idea that we now have of the sovereign individual human self, is really being developed for the first time. This is the first time that anybody has thought that, you know, about human beings, that we have sovereign individual selves and we are the master of our own destiny. You know, and that is, I think, if there's a single overarching gift of the Renaissance to the modern world, that you know, the idea, the humanist idea of ourselves as sovereign individual beings, you know, is it. I mean, the birth of humanism in the Renaissance is probably the greatest thing that it did for us, more than the Michelangelos, more than the Duomos, so on, you know. And interestingly, in India, at the same time, it's not exactly the same thing, but there's also beginning to be in the court of Akbar a questioning of the extent to which human beings should be considered to be subservient to their gods.
You know, yes, he found himself using the first person.
He tried to be an I rather than a we, and unfortunately nobody noticed.
Not even Jodha.
But so these it seems to me that's the profound revolution of what that period which we now call the pre-modern age. The great thing it gave to the modern, and actually the thing which allowed the modern to be born, you know, was this idea of individualism, the idea of the individual self. And so, yeah, I wanted the book to talk about, to show people wrestling with that idea. You know, what does it mean to be an I? What does it mean to be a person who doesn't simply take his responsibility from his family or his religion or his people or his clan or whatever, but is simply morally responsible for himself? Mm-hmm. It's a new burden. You know, it's a burden selfhood. You know, it's a responsibility as well as a liberation. And I wanted to show people wrestling with that idea at the moment at which it came into being.
That man could possibly be the center of the universe.
Yes, man. Man at the center of everything, not God. The religion of man, which is what humanism is.
Yes. And Akbar wanted so much to be enlightened. He says that the one quarrel he had sought to end was the quarrel over religion.
The quarrel over God, yes. Is that... Well, he didn't succeed, did he? And I think he understands that in the book, which might be slightly me putting it in his head, but at the end of the book, he does understand that maybe his great project, tolerance, you know, pantheism, inclusion. That project will fail. And he sees that as being the failure of his life. And maybe he's right.
Sir Salman Rushdie, if language upon a silvered tongue affords enchantment enough, I thank you for your continuing enchantment
thank
as
you,
a
sir.
Writer.
Oh, thank you so much.
It has been a privilege.
Thank you.
To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or browse our suggested reading list for both adults and children. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor and technical producer, Mike Johns. Production assistant, Connor Adams. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue, and I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Between the Lines is a production of WABE Atlanta.